Welcome back to Optimism Vaccine. I'm Steve. It is a special night. It's a yearly tradition that needs no introduction. The best and brightest from Tinseltown are ready to walk the red carpet and receive recognition for dazzling us on the silver screen. And joining me today, dressed to the nines in his best tuxedo, Adam Myros.
Hello, Steve.
You excited to discuss the nominees this year?
Most excited I've been in years.
It's great. It's great. Also joining us, he's known as Ireland's Joan Rivers. It's Jack.
Yep. As of this day forward, I am known as Ireland's Joan Rivers. That's very true.
Biting, incisive commentary, a good sense of humor, and you're dead. That's how we know.
And yep, that's it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely dead. After this slate, it's been been a whole thing.
It really has.
Does the daughter still have that gig?
I think so. I think Melissa Rivers is still doing shit on the red carpet. I got to be honest though. I don't watch a lot of red carpet shows, which is strange. You would think that I would watch more given what we do on a week to week basis. But I think a big part of it is since all three of us are esteemed critics and sort of part of those inner Hollywood elite circles, we find ourselves more on the red carpets than commentating on them. So it makes sense that I don't know what the fuck's going on with Melissa Rivers, right?
Yeah, definitely my experience with this whole thing. Yeah,
for sure. For sure. Well, gentlemen, I guess we should just start talking about these Best Picture nominees for the big awards show. So why don't we start off with a film that is predicted to sweep all of the major categories, and it's a story of changing the world forever with an invention that most people previously thought was just impossible. Critics have called it an effective blend of historical documentary with a dramatic thriller and biography, and they've said that it turns defining moments in history into pulse-pounding thrills, and they've called it a cinematic explosion. And of course, we're talking about Edwin Brown's Irresistible. You know, this is a movie where I don't know. I tend to think of it as like The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, but like more fucking. And that's because it's primarily about a guy who's just, he's not happy with his life. But thanks to a stranger by the name of Miracle Myers, he's able to use a time machine to kind of fuck his way through the women of history. And wow, what a beautiful cinematic palette. Yeah, even ones that don't exist.
They run out of women of history, like they get one and then they go to Juliet, Romeo and Juliet. I really love this. Incredible that this wonderful Jewish caricature invents a time machine and decides the best application for it is to charge a man $10 a go to just get his rocks off is incredible, frankly.
I mean, the world would never be ready for such a thing, but it does seem silly because, you know, on its face, like, oh yeah, this guy just has a time machine in a warehouse somewhere, and then you can just pay to fuck Cleopatra. But I don't know. It seems oddly predictive of our future because as technology develops, specifically in the realm of, you know, the internet and AI and all these different things, it's never the best or the worst possible scenario. We always find ourselves in the dumbest possible scenario. So I do believe that if time travel were invented, the amount of time between the invention and people being able to fuck Cleopatra, I think would be almost non-existent. Like that would probably be the first thing developed from this technology. Yeah. So
I think this asks some interesting questions, definitely, because when you think about it, like Time Cop asks interesting questions about, you know, if we had time travel, we would need time police to stop people from taking advantage. But frankly, the only like sex thing I really remember from that was a dude with the VR headset in the future. People weren't going back to bang at all. They were going back to murder cowboys with machine guns, which is Yeah, the film really missed on a trick there. They really should have gone, this is You Need Irresistible as the counterpoint for the sexual time tourist avenue.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you're onto something.
I don't know.
Here.
I think sexual time tourism might be, like, disappointing. I get the sense a lot of these historical figures probably aren't as glamorous as one might anticipate.
Or have such good English, I think,
I'm sorry, are you calling Joan of Arc's pussy beet? Is that what you're saying, essentially?
It's probably not beet at all. It's probably quite virginal, but, you know.
Yeah, what age was she when she died, Steve? I think the pinnacle of pics there.
I mean, there's a hygiene differential between these eras, I think.
Well, let me ask you something, Myros. Just a little, you know, experiment here, just a little philosophical game, if you will. If you had a time machine, would you go back in time and fuck baby Hitler?
No, I would use it exclusively to get rich, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't have to work any longer.
It seems like Back to the Future kind of has it. Like Biff was onto it. He figured it out. Yeah. You go back, you get the sports almanac, and then you just bet on everything and you're good. That's all you need.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know about like modeling a town after yourself. I'd probably just keep to myself so no one discovered that I had done this, but you know.
Low profile, definitely. That's the way to go. That's the way to go. So Irresistible, obviously nominated for Best Picture. And this is a fun one because we're in this period where, like, I think vintage pornography and the idea of like what it could be beyond just something to kind of get your rocks off with. We're kind of at the end of that golden period. So there was a brief window of time where pornography was largely still being exhibited in actual theaters, and there was enough money flowing in that people were really committed to making these kind of big budget pornos that maybe were a little bit more highbrow, high minded, high budget than the things that we're used to. And we really are at the end of this era, because I think once you get the ubiquity of home video and the primary consumers of pornography move from public theaters into, you know, home consumption, then that appetite for big epics kind of goes away. And then also you kind of have the undercurrent in the pornography industry of it being, I don't know, more blue collar, straightforward, I guess, and without all the hoity toity artsiness. So yeah, you've got a movie like Irresistible that kind of walks that line. So, you know, it did still think of itself as maybe a little more high-minded than your average porno. There's an R-rated version of Irresistible that exists. But despite the time traveling, this is still, it's still pretty dumb as fuck. And it also still largely sticks to a classic porno structure, which is you have like your present day timeline, but then there's all kinds of like daydream sequences, flashbacks, flash forwards, vignettes, essentially, where all the fucking takes place. So it is a great example of old world versus new world pornography. Is it the, you know, over the top epic that truly deserves to be called the next best picture? As our king of awards seasons, the Uncle Fester of Film Crit, Matt Neglia, would often ask, is this the next best picture, you guys? Is this our winner?
I think that'd be like Ski School winning Oscar or something. Like even in its most tame form, this is just an empty-headed romp, you know? But I don't know. I guess I just haven't thought about it enough, because I when you do think about it, it does bring up a lot of interesting questions. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to, you can avoid a time paradox, I suppose, by bringing back a fictional character. That is one way around some of the philosophical component and you know, the laws of physics that govern such things. I think this is a good workaround.
It does.
If you're going to travel in time and bring someone back to have sex with, you might as well be a fictional character.
So you're saying this is like the porn primer, effectively, like a lot of a lot of work has gone into to finessing the details.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was really thought through. You know, I don't know why Juliet, who again is a historical figure that doesn't exist, but also is supposed to be like 13 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was an interesting pick on that front, I got to admit.
I just think it's amazing that when they're writing this movie and they go, okay, so it's this thing. And then he goes back in time and he can bang all these, you know, hot chicks throughout history. So they're like, all right, name a woman, name a historical broad. Cleopatra, love it, love it. Like the obvious choice there, right? You go, all right, name another woman. Juliet from Romeo and Juliet. Not a real person and an actual child. Great, really good movie. And then Juliet's so into it that she fucking like Kate and Leopold's the whole thing. And then
and becomes a stripper.
Becomes a stripper in the present day.
Yeah, I mean, you got to hand it. First off, let's look at this as a work of innovation, because it occurs to me this is this came out 3 years before Back to the Future, which would come up with the great idea of having an older man and a younger man have hijinks and time travel. So clearly, Zemeckis watched Irresistible, and probably once he finished himself off and cleared his mind, he was like, "We could make something with this." And next thing you know, we had a DeLorean and all this other stuff. You know, I mean, this movie could have had a DeLorean. It doesn't need it. It's got enough. It's got some jokes. It's got at least three sets. And I think that's, and a lot of curtains were necessary. And that's really, that's all you need. I mean, to be fair to this movie, what really carries is honestly is Richard Pacheco's lead role. I think he's reminiscent very much of that golden era of pornography. You know, and like you mentioned, Steve, we're in a transitional period here. 84-ish was around the, like, I think that's the last year of the golden era before it switched to like the silver era as VHS took off and things kind of moved into more segmented video driven kind of like what would you say, like scenes, vignettes or whatever of you know, narrative fiction. But yeah, he's a guy who, frankly, you could just drop him in a real movie. He can act. He's quite good, honestly. Which is not something, you know, you would say necessarily you would expect in this industry, and certainly not this industry now. He's got a level of charisma that seems completely superfluous to the task largely nowadays, and kind of carries the movie, and that's you know, something. So and I think he won Best Actor, actually. Very exciting. So, you know, you want to check this one out for the performances.
Wait, these awards already happened? Why are we doing this?
he deserves to win Best Actor.
I have insider knowledge, Adam. I'm a little bird. Don't bet on it. Don't do time crime. Mm-hmm. All right? Because we've learned.
My question. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, we all know what happens.
Don't do time crime and leave Juliet alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder if this is riffing on, like, the Time After Time, the Nicholas Meyer film. That also involves fictional characters interacting with history for some reason. I don't know. It's a strange movie. And Steve's crack about Secret Life of Walter Mitty is almost like, was that intentional?
I think he's named Walter.
Yeah, his name is Walter, right?
that's the idea, right?
Yeah.
Cleopatra refers to him as Walter of Marin. Of course, Marion County is very smart little thing there. That's around the time when he gets arrested in ancient Egypt and he cries out they can because he's an American citizen, which frankly is maybe the most real the film ever gets.
Yeah.
We did skip over the Mata Hari.
Mata Hari, he just get to her. Well, and then I mean, eventually he gets to his own wife, but 20 years early, he cock blocks himself effectively, which is quite the maneuver.
See, this is where we really fall apart in the paradox.
You think she might notice her husband aging 20 years over the course of the wedding ceremony, but anyway.
You would think.
No, come on.
Again, it's a beautiful film about a man realizing that what he really loves is his wife 20 years ago.
As you said, really, this is the Richard Pacheco show, and I'm shocked that he hasn't done more mainstream films, not to disparage the cinematic achievements of Anal Annie Just Can't Say No, or Sex Wars or Sex Loose. But I think that he yeah, he could branch out more. He could be the real deal. And I think he's up against some pretty heavy hitters in the best actor category, including Jerry Butler. Are you familiar with Jerry Butler?
We all love Jerry Butler.
We love Jerry Butler. But I think Jerry Butler is, I think he's the gold standard when it comes to like autobiographies about people who were in the porn industry for extended periods of time, specifically with male performers. So yeah, Raw Talent by Jerry Butler. Go pick that up on Amazon.
Pacheco, of course, has broadened his horizons because he's picked up, and we'll discuss it, he's picked up a supporting actor nod as well, which mm-hmm. is really a showcase, a testament to his own abilities.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, he's up against, I mentioned Jerry Butler, also Ron Jeremy, this young newcomer, Ron Jeremy.
Oh, yeah.
Clearly someone who has a bright future ahead of him and will never commit heinous crimes, which, you know, he's never been held accountable for because he has advanced dementia. That'll never happen. As well as John Leslie, very famous in the industry. And of course, the chiseled body of Eric Edwards with his riveting performance in Sexcapades. So a lot of great competition. Could really go anyway, but Richard Pacheco is my choice. We got a lot to talk about, though, so I suppose we should move forward. Let's talk about a film that it's really putting married life under the microscope. Critics are calling it an intricately layered, surgically controlled drama. They're saying it's a poignant exploration of human relationships with a layered script and exceptional performances. It's also got like Ron Jeremy and fucking mime makeup. We're talking about Scoundrels, of course. Wow. And this one kind of blew me away for multiple reasons. One, it's definitely got its artsy fartsy moments, and it is about as serious as a film like this can get. And then also, Ron Jeremy is a conventionally attractive man, which I did not think he was ever that. So
didn't you learn that from Taboo?
I mean, even in Taboo, like he's in Taboo, but I think he's a little sexier here.
Yeah, I think the main thing here is that he's the lead. You know, I've always seen him really as kind of a supporting player primarily, mm-hmm. but you know, it's great to see him step up, and you know, seems like a bright future. And as Steve mentioned earlier, I think a good egg, probably nothing going to go sour here.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. How could anything go wrong?
But yeah, it's an interesting movie. It's of course, this is what Howard Cecil directs. Touch of class, really, to it. It's a really good looking movie. A lot of gel lights, cinematic, really. You know, it's a great kind of like a kind of adult drama, and it's not just adult because, you know, they all bang each other or don't mm-hmm. bang each other and bang other people. But I mean, isn't that the family?
Yeah.
In pornos, typically, yes, it is. You're correct. That's the problem. Uh-huh. And Jeremy playing a psychiatrist, I think, is just a particularly incredible, excellent detail to add in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny because if you look at the synopsis of this film and just like base level, it's about a psychiatrist and he discovers that his wife's kind of cheating on him, and then also that his daughter is just trying to fuck everybody. And you know, what do you do? Oh no. And this sounds like almost like a setup for one of the Taboo movies or any number of conventional pornos. But this taps into some, I don't know, some real weird shit. And it's like, oh, it's kind of about like middle class ennui and the lack of fulfillment in trying to fix your marriage by just fucking people outside of it, you know, in a non-consensual way. And it's, yeah, it gets into some of the deeper issues here.
Right. I don't think a Bergman movie has ever had a scene where a man goes to a prostitute and says, I have a daughter around your age, and then she eats his ass. I don't mm-hmm. think Bergman ever even touched that.
No, because, well, Bergman's a coward, as we all know.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. He is now, I realize. There's so much more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cecil Howard, on the other hand, he's on a whole different level. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned too, Jack, just the way that this film looks and how it's so distinct. I mean, specifically as a pornographic film, but just in general, it's a very striking movie. And I think a big part of that is Cecil Howard, before he got into porno, he was an art director. So he's, you know, he's got an eye for art direction, photography, and he knows how to make things pop. So it's nice that he had that background coming into porno and then is sort of able to bring that creativity here. Because, yeah, visually, this is amazing. And it's also another one of these films nominated for Best Picture that an R-rated version does exist. And somehow it exists, and they only had to cut out 36 seconds of footage, which that blows my mind. But...
Well, I think that's probably not quite accurate. I'm guessing it's 36 seconds of time difference. Yeah. There must have been an addition.
Yeah, a lot of the R-rated movies stuck a lot of extra talking back in. But I mean, at the same time, this movie, this isn't just a wall-to-wall fuckfest. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got your scenes like nicely spread out throughout. But I mean, this is there's a lot of talking. There's a lot of acting here. There is, Adam mentioned, we have a whole Greek chorus kind of set up with the main trio family all in mime makeup, kind of narrating their own internal lives at certain points. It's it's reaching somewhere, and it is funny, this film, goddamn, this film looks better than shit that's playing in a multiplex right now.
Yeah, it does. It really does. That was my biggest takeaway when I threw this on. I was like, Jesus Christ, like this.
What have we lost?
Yeah. What's going on? Why?
Like, I mean, I know it's small mind to say, oh, porn, it's like it's cheap and it's shitty and everything. Like, and you should, you know, and like it's more open minded to say, like, no, it's a really interesting, vibrant industry. But I really do think that mainstream Hollywood should probably not be coming so far behind now. I think that's probably a problem.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my first thought is, why can't we give Cecil Howard $200 million? But the real takeaway should be, if your film costs $200 million, I don't know, it shouldn't look like shit. And
yeah, plus this movie is like a 50s rock theme, all like custom written for it with the film's title in it.
Mm-hmm.
Not every movie has that, but Scoundrels has that. Plays right at the start as Ron Jeremy's driving home and then splits his pants. great opening for a movie, and then, you know, chats to his wife who's fantasizing about his best friend and a tennis lesson or something.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if I had to pick right now, gun to my head, what's the next best picture? I think I'm going Scoundrels. Because this one, I mean, I was at rapt attention with this. I could not believe.
Oh, I mean, it's got all the hallmarks, quality. And I mean, certainly it's a film, I think, that marries, you know, artistic intention with a mainstream appeal. It's a very, very easy film to watch.
Yeah, totally.
Even with its discordant experimental tonal soundtrack set to slow motion cum shots. Mm-hmm. Even then, it still feels really slick compared to most of the rest of this stuff.
Absolutely.
You know, appeal to the Sean Glynnis segment who's looking for a thrilling twist ending.
Do you want to talk about that ending a little bit, Myros?
Quite the thing.
Because
I guess that the whole mime thing is them being dead the whole time. I guess. I don't know.
Are they all dead? I don't remember.
It was a car accident. He's dead for sure.
Well, he is, but I don't know. Is there anything that kills the other two? I think it's just him. I think it's just, you know, like, you know, through the looking glass. So this is a place where they are able to speak their minds freely to open the film up to keep things rolling. I don't know. I think it's an interesting twist at the end where he dies basically because the woman he's kind of eloping with basically says that it's like, what did she say? She says, oh, you know, Mary, you're a doctor. My mom always said I should marry a doctor. And it's very clear that's exactly the same thing his wife probably said to him when they started dating. And he is so horrified by this, that having just thrown a cream pie in a police officer's face, a scene that's even more confusing, then crashes and dies. And that's honestly kind of a great ending to the movie. It's, you know, like there's no escape, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
She's a younger, more beautiful, you know, girl or whatever, more desirable and new and novel, but really he's just repeating the same things. He's trapped.
Yeah,
who doesn't want to be reminded of that when you're jacking off?
Exactly. And I think we should really lean into the whole, oh, you know, they were dead all along theory that Myros is floating here, because that's a really popular one with internet film criticism right now. And I think it's the one thing that is keeping Optimism Vaccine from truly sweeping the internet and becoming the most popular film podcast, is we need to start creating little theory YouTube videos and TikToks about how any, you know, motion picture that comes out, the twist is they were dead all along, and that's how you make sense of the plot. So
I mean, it's difficult to do that in the era where people like where we recently had discussion, does Saltburn have a twist?
Yeah, that's my favorite twist is there a twist or is the movie stupid? That's right. That's the biggest twist of all.
That's a tricky one. Oh yeah, one other thing about Scoundrels I just want to mention as a mark quality is, of course, this is the only film that we're discussing in this episode that features Orson Welles, admittedly via television. And I'm not even sure which movie it is. I wasn't. It might be The Stranger. It's a little mustache, but I'm really not sure. Yeah. Briefly glimpsed, but Orson Welles nonetheless appearing. So that's interesting. Of course, Orson Welles worked with Gary Graver, who shot a lot of pornography, but he ever got in one himself. So
it's too bad.
It is The Stranger, Jack.
It is the stranger. Okay, good to know. I thought that might be it. I was identifying mostly off of which era of mustache I was seeing.
Yeah. Myros, do you think Orson Welles is a generous lover?
It seems quite unlikely. I have taken a course on...
Don't you think Rita Hayworth just went with anyone?
Yeah, I did take a course that extensively studied some archival footage that he had, including some correspondence with his wife that he abandoned in order to go to Hollywood.
And nice.
Yeah, he didn't really come across...
What was the first wife? Where is he abandoning her from? Well, actually, he was probably abandoning her from New York. Because he didn't get married in Wisconsin. So, yeah, okay. Well, yeah, he's probably shitty then. I was saying, you know.
Yeah, he seemed like a distant lover, we'll say.
Like geographically distant.
Geographically and emotionally.
Yeah, I think emotionally before geographically.
All right. Well, let's move on to the next movie. Let's talk about a film about girls for girls. Finally, you know, critics have praised its lavish production. They're calling it smart and visually dazzling and a frothy confection of fun. And of course, Leonard Maltin said, "When I became a father, I searched for movies that would show my daughter positive role models. And it was tough going, but this makes up for lost time and should warm the hearts of parents and daughters alike." What am I talking about? Of course, I'm talking about All American Girls, okay? Directed and written by the great Bill Milling.
Incredible to imagine that just a single man was able to write and direct such a film.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. What a complex and rich tome All American Girls is.
Yeah, this is the one that I have absolutely nothing to say.
Well, I mean, what can you say?
I guess things happen.
This is, I don't know. This feels like a podcast to me. Like, is this just an episode of Call Her Daddy? Like, it's just like a bunch of women sitting in a room talking about all their fucking escapades. That's...
Yeah, it kind of follows like the Cinemax model that you would see, not so much in the movies, in like the recurring shows that they'd run in the softcore block, where it would be like, Nikki Cox is a sexy radio host, and people just call in and go like, hey, you know what happened last week to me down on Sex Beach? And then we would cut away to Sex Beach.
Yeah.
And you know, on and on. And this is that, except more globetrotting.
Yeah, a lot of globe. That's what gets me about this movie. This one's up for best art direction, right, as well as best picture. And that's really interesting to me, because I don't know if the art direction is really good or really bad, because some of it looks very convincingly on location, and then some of it looks very much just a room with some curtains hung in it. And I'm not entirely sure which is which. There's one scene where in Hong Kong, that has a lot of footage of Hong Kong streets that I find it hard to believe they would have sent a camera over there to shoot that. But then one of the actresses does wander into a Chinese New Year's parade. And they just send her into a Chinatown parade to just pretend to be there because it's very confusing. And I just don't think anyone would have bothered making the phone calls and arrangements to make this happen for the movie. Mm-hmm. And I should rewatch it again at some point and just see how confused the people in the parade might look when she wanders up to them. But yeah, this film is... It's just really confusing. It's like by turns, surprisingly adept and utterly kind of incompetent. And I kind of love it about it. Honestly, there's one scene in a classy restaurant where one of the all-American girls ends up fucking her professor on the table in front of everyone in the restaurant, who then applauds. Which frankly sounds like one of those made up stories you post on Twitter. But, you know, and it was so good. Everyone applauded. But my favorite part of it is it's a super classy restaurant. Obviously, it's supposed to be. But the restaurant menu is like a laminated sheet with like a cartoon drawing of a man on it that looks like a kid's menu they stole from somewhere else. It's a lot of
art
weird
direction,
things in
this. Jack. Set design.
This plus the girl in France who basically just walks around the corner of the Louvre to the hayloft to fuck two guys. There's a lot going on here.
Yeah.
Well, I will say that the credits list Paris, Hong Kong, Las Vegas,
San
Berkeley,
Francisco.
Central Park. These are all listed as filming locations.
Yes, they thank the people of all of these places cooperation in making the film.
Yeah.
Did they go to these places? I don't know.
I don't know.
It's hard to say. But I mean, even the fact that we're having this discussion, that's got to count for something.
Yeah. I think it plays into like one of the things that struck me about this film is that there's actually, despite it being set around the fact, it's just like it's a bunch of girls recounting their sexual escapades. So it's all just flashbacks kind of embedded into one framing mechanism. You think that would leave very little need to stay in the framing mechanism. And yet a surprising amount of the movie is just weird, superfluous details that don't seem to accomplish anything. There's an enormous amount of just kind of like, and we walked around and there's footage of them walking around and doing this and that. And they rented a whole mansion for that as well, for the framing device to walk around in. And you're kind of looking at it all going, for what this film is, none of this seems necessary.
Yes,
it doesn't seem to do much.
That's the only... So I think out of all of our Best Picture nominees, this one might be my least favorite, but
that's wrong, Steve.
I don't know. The one interesting thing here is the fact that it is kind of a lavish production, but we talked about this as they move into the video era, pornography really like the stories get smaller and they just become these little like closed vignettes with simple setups. And I mean, obviously, you know where it's headed. But here it's that very simple porno setup story structure. And it's given lavish production that doesn't really enhance the film in a meaningful way other than to make me scratch my head and be like, oh, why did they shoot this here? They probably didn't have to do that. And they truly don't make them like this anymore. Because if you were to make something like this, it'd just be, I don't even know, fucking green screen if you're lucky. So
right. That's why I don't think this is the worst. This one confused the hell out of me.
Yeah,
it's probably going to stay with me. I mean, and there is something genuinely funny to me when one of the girls recounts the time she banged a guy on the staircase by a violin recital, that it opens with a dude look genuinely playing violin, so far as I could tell. I think they hired a guy who could just knock stuff out, like all your classical standards. And he's in a like tux and tails doing that in front of an appreciative room full of people all admiring his music in a lavishly apportioned mansion, probably a different room of the one they filmed all the rest of it in. and he's just hammering out these tunes on a violin, and this girl is like 4 feet away from him and just says, "This is boring." And then goes to have sex with the violin's assistant, whose job it is to turn the pages, which I don't know. I feel like for the pieces he's playing, most violinists probably are going to know these if they're performance grade anyway. But also, it's previously established that the staircase is in line of sight from where he's playing violin. So it's kind of weird that no one notices them having a threesome over there. But yeah, it's, you know, these are the tales that bond all American girls.
Yeah, relatable. It truly is. I mean, and that is what makes all American girls so special is, you know, every woman has had these experiences. You know, they all have these stories to tell. Who among us has not gone to the orchestra and just blown a violin player in the stairwell?
I thought you were going to say gone to the Orient.
That's right, the Far East. This one is, it's something special for sure. But hey, why don't we move on to a film by one of the greats, an absolute legend in the world of pornography. And this is the story of insatiable desire and love spanning across time. And it's one that critics have called a tone poem and a truly modern romance, rich with bittersweet understanding of what it means to live in the present. That's right. It's a movie about recalling fuck tales of old. Night Hunger. Myros, you big Damiano guy?
Yeah. No, this is a demented film. I give him props. I mean,
you know, and this one is, it's nominated for Best Picture, and certainly it has a claim to that. I think this could run away with it. However, it is one of the more divisive films in the Best Picture category.
Sure,
Scoundrels. A little more extreme than most mainstream fare, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, Scoundrels, certainly, I think I'm going to back that as a likely winner because I just think that it's got some ambition, but it's pretty slick. It's enjoyable. I think it's going to capture a wide market. Night Hunger is the real outsider art house piece, and I think arguably the best film of the batch, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is just it's a very peculiar film. I've long admired Damiano's kind of interest in pornography. He's obviously an innovator, he's a genius, he's a towering monument within the porn industry. He's revolutionized it several times over at this point. I think it's amazing that he's mostly done that by making porn movies about how sex is awful. I think that's a really interesting choice.
How many Damiano movies have like super downer endings where it's almost like you're being scolded for making it to the end?
Quite a few of them in my experience. And they're mostly about how sex is basically for damaged people to just kind of like push away the feelings that hurt them so much. And you're supposed to whip it out to this one, which is really gambit, certainly. And that's why, you know, quietly I'm backing this one, you know, because I'm a very cultured thinking individual, but I'm not sure that the Academy are gonna go for this. I don't think the voting body have what it take to push Night Hunger over the top to win at all, you know.
I don't know. Don't discount the sort of Lifetime Achievement Award going on.
Yeah,
here.
That's
we
true.
We could get that effect for Damiano's body of work.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean,
what a body.
What a body. Yeah, very, very ambitious. But you have to remember, too, that when we're talking about these major award shows, there's a certain level of populism that you kind of have to reach in order to really kind of nail down that guaranteed Best Picture win. It's not very often that Best Picture is given to a movie that is really pushing artistic boundaries. You know, they'll throw that to Best Director, Best Screenplay, things like that. They'll give you news there. Just like the real mainstream stuff, obviously, that's where you get into the art direction categories and special effects. But yeah, with Best Picture, it has to be critically acclaimed, but very digestible. And I think the problem with Night Hunger is it is, even in Damiano's broader filmography, it doesn't feel like one of his more accessible films.
Sure, yeah.
So what's the turnoff, you think, to mainstream audiences? Is it the meta film aspect, or is it the Golden Shower aspect?
Yeah, this is kind of like
a little Colm A, Colm B kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, it's because people have been asking for a long time. They're saying, I like Fellini's 8.5, but what if there was like a little piss scene in there? Would it enhance the experience? I think it would.
Well, I mean, let's talk seriously here, okay? Because, frankly, I think one of the travesties of this award ceremony, this award season, one of the great overlooked performances is Sharon Kane playing Fuck Pig,
mm-hmm.
and pissing on herself in Night Hunger through the magic of motion pictures. She's achieving this. It's done through clever editing. You know, you have to look close, but you'll figure out how to do it. But she's pretty goddamn good in this movie. She's delivering a real, like, she commits to her role. And I'm not just talking that she's willing to have someone pee on her, possibly for, I don't know if it's for real or not, you know, mm-hmm. but either way, she delivers several impassioned dramatic monologues here about being broken and scared that are, oh, it's pretty good, frankly. And she is not up for best actress or even best supporting actress, which could, you know, I mean, this is another kind of a vignette kind of a film with a broader frame device. You know, how do you overlook work like that? It's absurd, you know. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, Scoundrels has best actress nods for two of its performers, and nothing against them, but I think, frankly, one of them has better work in another film, the last one we're going to discuss. Mm-hmm. And the other one is The Bored Wife. I mean, it's sort of, it's okay, but I don't think it's not Fuck Pig territory.
Yeah, I'm a big supporter of the hashtag justice for Fuck Pig movement. And I think a lot of people were outraged, and it just shows the bias against strong women in the industry. And sure, you know, this movie has, like 5 nominations at the awards. Best picture, best screenplay, best director, best cinematography, best editing. But clearly there might be some misogyny going down here if they can't give the nod to Fuck Pig. Am I right?
I mean, it is probably the most outstanding element in the film. Mm-hmm. Frankly, that whole segment is just like, what, where did this come from? Yeah. This is like,
and I'm not trying
shit.
To sidebar completely to snubs and flubs, but come on. How do you not? Yeah.
I mean, and yeah, it's like Adam says, like the standout sequence. I mean, the first flashback to clarify, I mean, we basically have a barman telling an interested customer the lurid sexual details of somehow a single family lineage of people who are all sex addicts, essentially compelled to fuck eternally. And they all live in the same house in different eras, I guess. It's mm-hmm. funny, I guess offspring would be no problem for people with this issue, but they don't really have any family resemblance. But we open with a flashback to, I get what, the 1800s sometime? I'm a bit unclear of the time zone or the time
this is
line.
This is a strange one. I'm unclear about a lot of things about this.
It's
like,
really,
is this called Night Hunger because it's a Dracula?
It's basically porno Jim Steinman video. Like, Jim Steinman could have written a song to go along with this sequence. It would have fit. A lot of frilly kind of blouses and things like that. You know,
I don't know. There's less sexual tension in this than there is an Interview with a Vampire, if you ask me. But whatever.
Fair, yeah. But the guy is really hamming it up. He's having a real Dracula monologue, and I'm like, is this a Dracula? Is this guy supposed to be a Dracula? I can't tell.
No, yeah, I mean, yeah, I think he's just a sex addict. But
that's his
right.
Night Hunger. It's vampirism and, you know, sex. They're one and the same.
Well, I mean, who's the original, like, you know, fuck machine in literature? It's got to be Dracula, right? Like, makes sense.
Yeah. It's interesting because it goes to Night Hungers. Many of us will go to the fridge, but not this guy. He's going to his harem of women, and then also mm-hmm. his wife, who he begs to understand that his sexual lusts are too great to be contained. But it's not love, it's just thrusting. Which, of course, makes this a forebear to Chiming Liang's The Wandering Cloud.
Mm-hmm.
which none of the other films are like at all. So I guess that's something Night Hunger has going for it too.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we have to posit the possibility that he's not going out and banging women. He's drinking their blood.
Yep.
It's possible.
And peeing on them.
Sometime later. I mean, I think the big flub, of course, in the peeing scene is that it's supposed to be in the 1960s, but it's clearly like an 80s rock band sound that they've got going on there. It's a bit, a bit of a screw up there. But if Sharon Kane is doing her own singing on top of everything, again, I am just bamboozled at how she is not up for Best Actress. It's an absolute disgrace.
Absolute amazing talent. So. One day.
My other favorite thing about this movie is, as I say, the framing device is basically a dude just wanders into a bar and the barman just takes a shine to him and decides to tell him about the house on the hill full of all the fucking people.
And the bartender also looks like fucking Haystacks Calhoun.
He's got charisma. I would watch that man in,
which
in
also,
anything.
If you're not familiar with Damiano's Night Hunger, at least Google image search Haystacks Calhoun, like that'll give you.
Can you believe I think this is this man's only performance in the film industry, which is a goddamn shame. I mean, they're sitting on a little treasure here. He's doing a great job relaying
absolutely.
It. But I do love that he's essentially telling this poor sop who just wandered in to have a beer these stories of insatiable lust. And I kind of wish we could have the footage of him telling the man these stories rather than us seeing the reenactments. I think it would be amazing to have a guy just trying to like suck down a beer in peace while a dude tells him all about the time the lady's now gone to like start peeing on herself and talking to herself via monologue and the man fucking three women and it intercuts. There are lots of artsy things to this. I mean, opening scene where vampire man is having sex with all these women and intercuts to make it like he's, you know, it's all happening simultaneously. The women are interchangeable. It's I mean, Damiano certainly, I think, is bringing an art house intellectual edge that none of the other films have. Even Scoundrels, you know, at its best is not batting at this level. And you could argue this is at this point, Damiano's kind of like his best work is behind him. He's still, you know, kind of he's reusing the same elements a little bit, but I think he's still far ahead of the curve here. Although I'm going to give a shout out as well, frankly, Night Dreams, Café Flesh, rather, not up for Best Picture. I think that's a mistake.
Big snub.
Personally.
There. Yeah.
Big snub. Huge snub.
Huge.
Huge throbbing snub.
I think that time will be kind to Café Flesh and, you know, future generations will discover and appreciate it, I hope. But hey.
Well, here's hoping they discover this one as well, because it's a bit of a hidden gem, and it, you know, could probably use a little, we don't want to let these prints go to pot, because, you know, we might want to look at these in future generations.
No, I just do that. well, we got one more Best Picture nomination to talk about, and this is the only film nominated for Best Picture about an adult baby trying to fuck their way through life to find fulfillment and a meaningful connection. And critics have called it wildly imaginative, exhilarating, and a movie with, quote, filmmaking that evokes a sense of wonder and discovery in its audience. It's directed by the great Anthony Spinelli, a critical darling who's no stranger to admiration in big award shows. I didn't like this one.
I'm not sure I enjoy Bros Before Hoes, the motion picture, which segues somewhere in the middle into Rain Man Gets Laid.
Yeah. That's, I mean, I don't know. That's, if you frame it that way, like if we were in an elevator and you pitched me Rain Man, but you're trying to get the Rain Man to get his dick wet, I'd be like, I don't know. You might be onto something. There's something there.
Well, I would disagree, Steve, because that scene where he's fucking like rain manning all over the condom is one of the most horrifying things I've watched in a long
time.
I
dare anyone to try and maintain an erection through that scene. I think in a lot of ways.
Do you want to describe that in greater detail for our listening audience? What you're.
I fear our Patreon might not support such acts.
I can't describe it in greater detail because I've purged it for my brain, frankly.
Oh wow, this is almost like frat bro Cassavetes, if Cassavetes was kind of dumb. Yeah. There's a huge amount of ambition in Nothing to Hide. I you can't deny that. It's really, again, there's an R-rated variant cut, so they've got a family-friendly version. But you can laud ambition, and this is a very much a developed kind of central dramatic relationship between two characters, a broader narrative element to it. But the problem is that none of it really works, which gives you the ultimate problem. It's just not a good movie.
Yeah,
really. It's an okay porno, but probably not even. The kind of the sex scenes are few and far between at certain points. And then you like have that aforementioned Rain Man sex scene, which is biggest goddamn turnoff you could imagine.
It's rough stuff.
I don't know. Like, the thing with me is like, I love a good porn parody. Okay. And I love a good literary adaptation, but of Mice and Men, porno version, not something I'm really that interested in. And that's just kind of where this is headed.
I mean, it was part of the thing is like the first hour and 20 minutes of this movie. This movie, by the way, is nearly an hour and 40 minutes long, which seems unnecessarily. Everything else we're talking here is like 70 to 80 minutes tops. So just like in, get it done. Not this one. This is pretensions of being, you know, a real motion picture. And that just leaves you a lot of time to try and figure out if the great Richard Pacheco, again, it is he's nominated for Best Supporting Actor for this film. He's trying to work out, is he actually developmentally disabled? It's hard to say. I don't know. And I think by the end of it, they confirm he is, which makes it work. Like, you just think at the start, it's like he's a little dumb. He's a little slow on the uptake. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a little sheltered compared to his, you know, more outgoing guy who just has sex with ladies all the time while Pacheco's character stands around. But yeah, no, it turns out he may actually have like a learning disability, which makes his friend's behavior seem criminal. Possibly
horrifying. Yeah, horrifying. He's just like,
yeah,
I'm gonna take this developmentally disabled man into my home and have him sleep in the bathtub. And continuously talk to him about how I'm going to have the woman I just fucked fuck him next. And kind of wheel him around town, spend their days like climbing on playground.
Do you think he's collecting a social security check on this guy's behalf or something?
That's entirely possible. Yeah, he's the king of the scumbags.
There's no reason why they would be friends. There's a flashback in this movie of how they first meet, which is actually weird because this movie is a sequel to a film called Talk Dirty to Me, which also is about the same two men and doesn't feature the scene where they meet. So it's really weird. It kind of goes back before that. But anyhow, there's a scene where they meet on a boat. It's like he pays a dollar because he's on a boat. The dumb guy is on a boat illegally and he gets in trouble for fare dodging. So the guy gives a dollar and then just instantly, like for no known reasons, like, you should be my friend. We'll hang out. It's like, what do they talk about? What do they do? What is the other guy getting out of this? Like, this guy's
they
not
seem
helping
to just
him
talk
get
about
laid.
Women being bitches. Yeah, women are bitches. You shouldn't have them in your life, you know. It's just good for getting off in and then you leave them on the curb. That's the ethos of this gentleman. And I guess the arc is that he learns his lesson because this developmentally disabled buddy is getting happily married to some roller skating idiot or something. But that makes it all the more baffling that this is a sequel, because what the fuck happened in the first
one? Do you think that this is part of like a broader cultural movement? I know that Netflix show Love on the Spectrum is really popular right now. Do you think this was an influence on it?
I would say probably they watched that. Yeah, I'd say probably there was kind of like a list of things not to do. And they were like, we best stay away from all this shit right here.
I have another question for you. Myros, I don't think you can have an answer for this, but I bet Jack does. Anthony Spinelli, famously known for his 1978 film Sex World. Do you think that this is an instance of someone who, you know, he's got the critical acclaim from some of his earlier works and he's sort of just getting kind of grandfathered in, kind of nudged in to the Best Picture scene?
Interesting question. And, you know, I think there's definitely an element of that. Spinelli is a known innovator. He's a big force Of course, made Water Power, I think. Oh, no, that was Sean Costello. Forget that. Mm. That was someone else. So it's someone else I have to wipe from my mind. But Anthony Spinelli. No, you know, I think the best picture nod for this one is there's ambition to spare in this film in terms of trying to make this really is kind of a hark back to the glory days of Porno Chic. I mean, this really is a real movie. It's got a plot character. It's got characters. It's got a narrative arc. It has sex scenes that communicate story details, as Adam mentions, because our playboy ultimately learns that his Rain Man companion's awkward bang with another roller skating lady has actually brought him a great degree of happiness that eludes our supposed hero with his kind of meritless trysts. You know, it's all of those things that people say movies should be. But like I say, the problem is that just if you dig into the details of it, even as for a second, it all falls apart. It doesn't make any goddamn sense why any of this is happening. But I couldn't expect the Academy to keep track of stuff like this. I think they were bamboozled by the ambition, by the production values, by the tree climbing prowess of the cast, and just you know, just kind of put it in as best picture. It's what, you know, probably what they think porn all should be. You know, it should all be more that's like why this.
You know, I think this is bound to win. This is my pick for sure.
Oh,
this
yeah,
is the sort of slop they just slurp up over there.
This is that thing you dump it off in the fall, and you got Meryl Streep lined up to play someone, and then the Academy just fucking slurps it up. They slurp it up.
Yeah.
It's rough. You know, it's. Yeah, like I just wish this amounted to more, frankly. You know, there's things in this I really enjoy. Early on in the movie, for example, they do a daring escape where our hero's having an affair with a married woman, and they have a daring escape where they drive away. And I thought that was enough. But no, they built a little wood like toothpick almost gate in the house that the car can drive through and smash, and it's very dynamic, you know, and they didn't need that. There was clearly not a gate there. They removed the real gate and built a one out of the shittiest lumber they could find for the purposes of not damaging probably the director's automobile. But you know what? That's I love that. I think that's great. I was ready to love this movie. Even as I was wondering what the hell the dumb guy's deal was, but I was lost by the end of it. I just wanted it to end.
Yeah. It definitely overstays its welcome. Speaking of overstaying its welcome, we got to wrap up this episode. So, Jack, what are you putting over this week?
I've brought it up earlier. I'm gonna put over Cafe Flesh. It's the movie to watch. It should be really running all of. I hope it wins every award it's up for. It's up for art direction. It's got to be a shoe in for that. But I think it's got some AGA supporting actor nod. But it don't think it even won got a scripting nod, which is insane. I mean, it's a porn movie questioning the very concept of voyeurism. It's smart, it's interesting, it's weird, but in an entertaining way. It's just a wonderful all-around porno. If you have to watch one hardcore pornographic movie right now, you should watch Cafe Flesh, I think.
All right, Myros, what are you putting over this week?
I'm putting over any and everything that's airing opposite the Academy Awards.
anything in particular, or just
I got my TV guide out here. No, just anything else, you know.
Just I like how they used anything. To do the put, like they would do like counter programming that actually made sense, like back when, like, you know, you'd have the Super Bowl going and then they would run the Puppy Bowl as counter programming. But now it seems like with all counter programming they've just completely given up. Like they just like whatever.
Well,
like
I think now with the Puppy
Bowl, the episode Puppy of Bowl, Cheers or something.
Yeah. Yeah, like the Puppy Bowl is now just part of the Super Bowl thing. Like it runs beforehand, so you can catch both.
So you can catch both, which is bullshit.
Yeah,
I think you should have. That's the Sophie's Choice for America. You fucking either watch the football game or you watch the cute animals. You get one or the other. You don't get both. Life is about tough choices. So, but yeah, Myros, I hope you'll be watching. I don't know, fucking reruns of American Dad and. King of Queens, or I don't know what runs. It's counter programming, but sure.
Yeah, well, sure. Sure, it's better, I'm sure.
Well, I'm going to put over a little movie that I watched this week, and you know, it's also about fucking, you know, maybe you could you jerk off to it? Possibly. But yeah, I went with Jack and we saw Gene Dielman in 35 millimeter at the Siskel in Chicago, and it was fantastic.
The greatest movie ever made.
I mean, it was real fucking good. That's for sure.
Yeah, honestly, it's the kind of movie I'd never seen it before, and I know everything about it because for years, you know, everyone talks about it, and it's obviously major. And you know, I know all the storyline beats. I know what's in it. I know how it ends. I knew all this stuff. And I sat down and watched it, and within like minutes, I was like, "Oh, this is major! Like, this is incredible!" So yeah, yeah, you know, honestly, the greatest film ever. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I'm also glad that I saw it in a movie theater because I was talking to Jack about this when we left, but I was like, "Yeah, there's no way I could fucking watch this at home because it's like, I don't even know what is it, 3.5 hours long or something, 3 hours long? I don't know."
Yeah, you should be thinking about what you need to do to make the dinner. Do you have the veal cutlets ready?
Yeah, probably so not. 3.5 hours, super, super, you know, slow and still. And then I'm just thinking of like, oh, and then, you know, two cats are fighting in front of me and then a car is squealing its tires outside of my house. No, I need to be in like a hermetically sealed room to watch this movie. So, yeah, theater was the way to go. So. All right. Well, if you enjoyed our insightful thoughts on this year's awards season, do us a favor. There is a link in the description of this podcast episode, and that'll take you to our Patreon page. And there you can give us money. And why would you want to give us money? Well, it's a great question. First of all, you help the podcast. You help us pay for hosting. You help us buy microphones and shit that we need to sound okay when we talk to you about movies. And also, there's lots of shit in it for you. It's not just about us. So if you live in the continental United States and you donate to the Patreon at any level, I will send you a movie from my personal collection. Perhaps a copy of Night Hunger. You don't know. You have no idea what you get.
Do you have a copy of Night Hunger?
No, but I could. Hypothetically,
burn to a DVD.
Yeah,
you can do that. I don't think it's been released on Blu-ray based on what I watched.
No, probably not. No. Anyways, yeah, so I'll send you a movie from my personal collection. You get that, and you also get access to our Patreon feed, which has all kinds of old podcast episodes and writing that we've done over the years that you can only access via Patreon, and then new stuff, new patron exclusive stuff that comes out on a semi-regular cadence, including, have we posted the newest patron episode yet?
It'll be up by the time this is up.
Wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful. So yeah, you got some brand new stuff to consume, children. So there has never been a better time to give us money. And if you want to donate at a higher level, if you are a ride or die Optimism Vaccine All-Star supporter, then you can donate at five and above. And what does that five and above get you? Well, you get to vote on future episodes because we believe in poll taxes. And you also get your name read out on the air. Myros, who are our five and above patrons right now?
We have David, Evan, Ryan, Dustin, and Paula.
God bless every single one of them. And of course, if you want to be the ultimate Optimism Vaccine superfan, or if you just want to use a small amount of money to, you know, punish us, that's fine too. $25, and it could be a one-time thing or a reoccurring thing, whatever you're comfortable with. $25, and you will get to choose an episode, a whole episode, whatever the fuck you want it to be, and we will make it happen. So, what an opportunity for you, dear listener. Other than that, if you have any questions, comments, death threats, marriage proposals, slow motion cum shots set to jazzy tunes, optimismvaccine@gmail.com or on whatever social media site you use, @optimismvaccine. We're probably around. Maybe. Maybe not. I don't know. And I think that about wraps it up. So, another big star-studded award year event. There's nothing else like it. Myros, I'll see you on the red carpet, buddy. You're not going to say anything?
No.